I think we should go ahead and get started, even though we're expecting a few more people in the audience, because we have been ordered to get out of here right at 12 o'clock for lunch. So welcome to SEJ's Freshwater panel. Thank you so much for coming. There's the coffee. Thank you very much. So I am Cynthia Barnett. I'm a longtime newspaper and magazine journalist and the rarest of birds, a fifth-generation Floridian, believe it or not. And so I was a newspaper and magazine reporter who became a water geek just watching this place that had such water abundance begin to face water scarcity. So I've written... My first book was about that strange tale of vanishing water in such a wet state. And my new book argues for a water ethic for the United States. So while many of you yesterday were learning about Florida's iconic species and wildlife bad guys, I was hanging out with the Miami-Dade Sewer Department, Water and Sewer Department. That's how much of a water geek I am. And... I learned some really interesting things, one of which is that Miami-Dade Water and Sewer is by far the largest consumer of electric power, the largest customer of Florida utility, Florida Power and Light, which is our, you know, sort of huge electric utility down in Miami. And Miami-Dade Water and Sewer is their largest customer in the entire southeastern United States. So just as it takes a great deal of energy to treat water and move it around, many people don't yet seem to make these connections about how much water it takes to make energy. So we have lined up a fabulous panel to help us connect all of these dots for our readers and our viewers. Many of you already know Peter Glick. He's president of the Pacific Institute in California and author of 9 books, including the biennial report, World's Water, and the 7th volume just came out last week. So, Peter, congratulations. That's very exciting. And I will attest that this is a must-have fact book for water journalists. Valerie Nelson is a PhD economist who directs the Water Alliance in Massachusetts, and she argues that to deal with water scarcity and climate change, we need an entirely different approach to water than the one we relied on in the 20th century. And finally, Bradley Udall is on the research faculty of the University of Colorado at Boulder, and he's principal investigator with NOAA's Western Water Assessment, studying the impacts of climate change on the Colorado River and the Western United States. So welcome to all of our panelists. You've all come a long way, and we really appreciate you coming to Florida to be with us. So I've asked each of our panelists to open with just about 5 minutes on how they view the freshwater story through the lens of their own work, and then I'll ask a couple of questions, but I really hope we can devote most of this session to your questions for the panelists. So I'll start with Peter and let you go down the line, and thanks again for being here.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Peter Glick from the Pacific Institute in California. I'm an environmental scientist by training. I've done a lot of work on climate and water, water and conflict, water and energy, the human right to water. But all of my siblings are journalists. Somehow I took a wrong turn somewhere, for which I apologize. But this is always one of my favorite audiences. I've been back to SEJ many times. The old saying is, you know, if I had 3 hours, I'm ready to speak now. If I only have 5 minutes, it takes me months to prepare. So I don't really have a prepared thing. Cynthia asked us to think about connecting the dots. The problem with water is there are a lot of dots. Water is a huge topic. It's connected to everything we care about. It's connected to climate. The hydrologic cycle is the climate system. It's connected to energy. It's connected to human health and ecosystem health, to food production, if you have been in any of the agricultural conversations around here. Ecosystems, it's a big thing. And there's a water story, I would argue, everywhere. And so what I thought I might do is just list a couple of things that we're working on at the Institute that are stories today, that might be stories tomorrow, and as maybe just a way of opening the conversation, which I think will be a little more interesting. Water and energy. Water and energy is a huge story. It takes a huge amount of water to produce the energy that this country requires, mostly for cooling, but for other things as well, increasingly for production, like fracking. The whole story of natural gas hydrologic fracturing, or fracking, for all those Battlestar Galactica fans, is a big story, and it's going to be a bigger story over the next few years. Climate change, in particular, extreme events and hydrology. The climate's changing. Humans are responsible. Brad can talk about this more. We're both working very closely on climate and water issues. There are a lot of pieces to the climate and water story, but an important one is extreme events. Extreme precipitation, extreme drought, look at Texas. Water shortages in the South Pacific, because those islands are also suffering drought for the same reason Texas is, but they have no water resources to speak of. So climate and extremes. I just tweeted yesterday a little story that I don't think anybody's, well, it's not true that nobody's picked up on it, but it would be a bigger story if it were in the United States. But central and parts of Central America have had 60 inches of rain in 10 days. It's unbelievable, that volume of rain. And 105 people are already dead, that's an example, a current example. Bottled water. I wrote a book about bottled water a year ago on the strange story of bottled water. I could not help, for those of you who are in this hotel, but take this from the bottled water that was in my room. $8.50 for a liter bottle of Evian. So I did the calculation. That's $27,000 for 1,000 gallons. 1,000 gallons is a typical way of measuring your water bill. You pay water bills, you typically pay $3 a 1,000 gallons. That's sort of a rough estimate. $27,000 a 1,000 gallons is what Evian in the hotel works out to. I took it because I see these all the time. This is the biggest number I've ever seen in a hotel. But so the bottled water story, and there are lots of pieces to that. Desalination. Everybody's favorite bullet. It was a big story here in Florida for a while because they tried to build a desalination plant in Tampa Bay. They did build a desalination plant in Tampa Bay. They're trying to build them in California. It's a technology we understand. It works. It's very expensive. It has environmental implications. It's everybody's favorite silver bullet, and it's got problems. And I won't go into that anymore. At the international level, the lack of access to safe water and sanitation. We don't think about that in the United States. Most of you are probably not on the international beat at all. But there are 1 billion people without access to safe drinking water worldwide, and there are 2.5 billion people without access to sanitation worldwide. And that leads to 2 million-plus deaths a year from avoidable water-related diseases, mostly cholera and dysentery, diarrheal diseases. Big story. The Millennium Development Goals set by the United Nations in 2000, they address a whole range of issues around poverty worldwide. They set targets for all sorts of things worldwide for 2015. There are a lot of them, but two of them are water-related. They are to reduce by 2015, to reduce the proportion of people without access to water and sanitation in half by 2015. It's not 2015 yet, and my crystal ball's no better than yours, but I'm predicting, and I very rarely predict anything, that we're not going to meet the Millennium Development Goal targets for 2015 for water and sanitation. It varies by region, but that's going to be a big deal. The water-intensive nature of energy, we talked about briefly, but the energy-intensive nature of water, Cynthia mentioned. Turns out it takes a lot of energy to move, treat, process, use the water that we require. And that's a big deal. Dade County is the largest consumer of energy in
the southeastern United States for FPNL.
Okay, so the largest single consumer of energy in California is the pumps that pump water over the Tehachapi Mountains from the Central Valley into the Los Angeles Basin. It's not a Florida unique situation. It takes a lot of energy to provide the water we want and the quality of the water we want and the reliability of the water we want. Here's another story. To me, a water wonk. Per capita water use in the United States is going down. And it's been going down for 30 years. But nobody seems to know or care. I care. Total water use for everything in the United States is going down and has been going down for 30 years. Population's going up exponentially. Our economy is going up exponentially, mostly. But our water use is actually declining, and on a per capita basis, it's declining faster because population, of course, is going up. That's sort of an interesting story. Himalayan glaciers. I'm actually on a National Academy of Sciences panel looking at the Himalayan glaciers and climate change. What do we know? It's a fascinating story, what we really know about the Himalayan glaciers. Extreme events I've mentioned. I'll just come back to extreme events to say one more thing about that. IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is about to release a report on extreme events, on what we know about the science of extreme events. The National Academy of Sciences is also about to release a water extreme event climate report. China, this is my last one. China, huge story around water. China's a big story anyway. Enormous water problems, both quantity and quality. We put out these books every 2 years. It's a sort of state of the world's water. The last volume 2 years ago had a story about China's water quantity and quality problems. This volume has a story about China's international dam policy, what they're doing in terms of building dams in China on rivers they share with neighboring countries and in Africa. China is the big world dam producer now, and they're building dams all over the world for electricity that they're going to consume in China, for agriculture, to support agriculture in Africa, for food products they're going to consume in China. It's an odd form of imperialism for a country that's still run by a communist government. Anyway, so China is a big story around water. I could talk about peak water. Maybe you were going to ask about that. I'll set that one aside.
Okay, I'll ask.
I wrote a story about peak water, a science paper about what it means, and it's sort of interesting. So I'm going to stop there.
I'll ask Peter about peak water and turn to Valerie.
Thank you, Cynthia. So the Water Alliance is a multi-stakeholder group, even internationally, that's trying to apply systems thinking to the arena of water. And I would agree first completely with the list that Peter said. I think there's a rapidly increasing understanding that we haven't looked at water properly, and we've greatly underestimated the importance of water in life support systems. For any of you who haven't seen the planetary boundaries work out of the resilience field, they're trying to identify 9 or 10 big ecosystem collapse scenarios. We've focused a lot on climate change, but there are many others of nutrients and biodiversity and toxicity, et cetera. And the most interesting thing for me is how water is integral to these ecosystem functions, and we haven't really grasped yet that we've looked at water as a commodity, a supply issue, maybe a pollution issue, but not how our mismanagement of the water system is right at the heart of the threats to global ecosystem integrity. And so that's one way into systems thinking. But the big story area that I spend most of my time on, as Cynthia said, is this growing realization on the part of many constituencies that, and I by that I mean advocacy groups as well as engineers, the private sector, that the way we have managed water is not only causing all these problems, but it's not fundamentally, economically, and institutionally sustainable. I mean, there's not just the water crisis, but there's the whole policy, economics, management crisis that is probably the first thing that any community would see. We don't have the money to do infrastructure in the ways that we have been doing it for 150 years. And we're in a situation, if any of you who were in the prior workshop, where EPA is increasing mandates, towns don't have money, and this system is going to move in a number of different ways. It may privatize. Oh, great, we'll get Wall Street financing all these projects. It may roll back. That's certainly what we heard in the last session. And in the House of Representatives, there's one bill after another. We'll just not do it. It's too expensive, so why bother? The field that I work in is that we need to use this water and economic crisis as the time to completely reinvent water management approaches. And we can go in more detail into those, but basically the story in water is a lot like that that's coming up in agriculture and energy. And it involves a shift out of siloed industrial scale systems, the industrial area. If you just think about huge treatment plants and big sewer and water grids, that are now massively degrading in this country. You know, some people say, well, let's take China and privatize, and that will fix it up to what it used to be. But that's not economically sustainable for generations, and it is also not going to grapple with the water crises that Peter and others have identified. So the new emerging sense, like in agriculture or energy, is we need to take a much more complex view of what we're trying to achieve. We need to downscale and integrate designs into buildings, use more natural systems, ramp up science so that we're actually targeting what we're trying to do with our management projects. And I could go into real communities like on Cape Cod where they're beginning to say, the way the Clean Water Act is asking us to do work is not financially sustainable. It doesn't even look as though it's going to deal with the siloed problem that the Clean Water Act is focused on. We need to shift right away and leapfrog like China into integrated, decentralized, multi-benefit solutions that rely on nature and also in complexity mimic nature. A lot of code words there. If any of you work in agriculture or energy, you'll sort of recognize that that's the storyline. So that's the story that I focus more on, but it's obviously related to this emerging understanding that if you grasp fully the complexity of water in ecosystems and how it has been so degraded, the only effective response is a completely different way of managing the water institutionally and economically.
Thank you, Valerie. Brad?
So my name is Brad Udall, and I'm at the University of Colorado, where I run a research program that NOAA funds. And then recently, I'm part of Department of Interior's new effort to make climate science centers around the country, and there are six of these. And I'm a PI on actually two of them, just because of where Colorado sits. I think I would make 5 points about water. And the first one is that too much water, too little water, water of the wrong quality is a major worldwide problem right now, independent of climate change. And I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but you need to make that statement to start this discussion. And when you look around the world, you can come up with examples of water quality, like these big dead zones that are appearing everywhere and exponentially increasing. You can look at the Pakistani floods in 2010. You can look at what's going on in China with their north-south diversion project, $63 billion infrastructure, 350,000 people moved for just one of these infrastructure tunnels or actually canals they're gonna build. You can look at Australia's drought they just went through, and I had the privilege of working 4 months this year for the South Australians in Adelaide for their Department for Water, trying to understand exactly what's going on down there, because the lessons coming out of Australia are truly incredible, and they're incredible about desal, they're incredible about policy, they're incredible about climate. They have done everything to try and get their water system into the 21st century. The second point is climate change is really water change. If you want an integrating theme for climate change, it's water, by gosh. It's not temperature. And you all know it's water that redistributes heat around the planet. And it's the Gulf Stream and it's water vapor. It's water that moves heat. And if you differentially heat the planet, as we're doing right now with the poles heating faster than the equator, you're going to change these patterns of water movement and hence weather and climate. The third point I'd say is that to date, especially in the West, when we deal with water solutions, we think of them as zero-sum games. And to some degree, that's true, but I would argue that we have got to get out of that. And because we do not have an effective market-based system, and we cannot use cash as a substitute for water, we're not allowed to do that, we come up with very suboptimal solutions to the problem. And the Australians have moved to water markets, and we're going to see that happen here, too. We have to. Otherwise, we're going to do some really dumb, stupid, and really expensive things, like talk about pipelines out of the Mississippi to Colorado. Finally, our action point four is that in the West, we obviously have these really significant problems, but in the last 5 years, what has gone on in the water provider communities has been astounding, actually, in many ways. You have Denver Water, which provides water to a million people, hiring a climate scientist to begin to work on water planning. You have the creation of the Water Utility Climate Alliance, which I think now totals 11 utilities, five on the West Coast, the big five. Las Vegas, Denver, Central Arizona Project joined, New York City, I think Tampa is now a member. And these general managers got together in 2007 because they realized the threat that climate change brings to their water supplies. And so I think there is some promise out there. We have a long ways to go. But I can remember giving talks in 2003 and 2004 to water management types and getting dirty looks. And I no longer get those looks. I now get the sense that this is a risk that they have to manage. And then let me just make a suggestion about solutions. I sometimes talk about the five rights on solutions. The first one I'd say is we need the right people in the room. In the American West, for 150 years, we've had three people in the room. We've had engineers, we've had attorneys, and we've had water users. We've not had physical scientists, we've not had social scientists, economists in particular. They've all been chased out. We've not had the general public. And those folks need to be brought into this discussion because the solutions we've had so far, I mean, they've all been in one realm, which is how do we increase supply? And we are now beyond that. We need the right priorities. And I think when you look to the Australians, they have three terms they come up with: critical human water needs. What is the absolute minimum amount of water our cities and economies need to function? And it's not excess water, but it's what do you need to bathe, drink, what do you need for industry, the minimal amount to run your cities. What's the environment need? Those two entities come first, and all other entities then come second, and that means ag and all other uses that might seem excessive, and there are lots of them. So the right priorities, right flexibility. Heretofore, our systems have allowed people to really hide from the climate variability that exists, and as we stress our systems more and more, we can't do that. We're going to have to come up with flexible systems. The right prices, and Peter, you've talked about this for years. Underpricing water leads to two things, one of which is obvious and one's not. The obvious one's overconsumption. The unobvious one is underinvestment. Underinvestment, money can do a lot to help us solve this problem. And then finally, I would say the right morality. And I love this Wendell Berry quote: do unto those downstream as you would have upstream do unto you. And then finally, those of us who work in this realm, you know, it can be depressing, although it's kind of exciting. Mike Young is an economist from Adelaide, and he likes to say, you know, this is sort of the golden time of water management. 40 years from now, we're going to have this figured out, and it's going to be boring. Author Bill Du Bois recently said, if you like to see landscapes change, you were born at the right time. And I guess my version of this is if you'd like to solve really difficult and incredibly important problems, you too were born at the right time.
That was great. Thank you, Brad. And I'm so glad you mentioned, oh, by the way, should I tell Pat Maroy that you called her idea to move the Mississippi stupid and dumb?
Pat and I have a good relationship, actually.
You can quote me on that one. Pat and I have a good relationship, too, except when we're not in the same room.
Pat is a good thinker and has pushed the boundaries, I think, on a lot of things in the West. And there are some just gross inequities in that Colorado River Compact. Mm-hmm. At some point in time, I think they're going to have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So I'm glad Brad mentioned Australia because John Fleck couldn't be here with the Albuquerque Journal, but I was talking to him about this panel, and we were saying, you know, it's almost like the Australian journalists got lucky because it was such a dramatic story. It was just like the water managers and the politicians jumping on water. Now the whole nation is focused on water because the big drought was such a crisis when the water levels in the dams all across the continent dropped below 35% capacity. So I wanted to ask the panelists, how do we in the United States, both as journalists and water people, how do we balance the creeping nature of U.S. water problems with the media need for crisis? I don't know who wants to tackle that one.
Well,
I guess it's going to be Peter.
Well, that's tough, of course. It's not just the water field. It's what's a story.
Mm-hmm.
What's the hook? And I get this asked all the time. And the good news is there's always, in my opinion, there's always a water story. There's always a water crisis somewhere. There's always an extreme event. Australia had a 9-year drought, but okay, look at Texas this year.
Mm-hmm.
Look at California two or three years ago. So there's always a water story. I'm not actually that worried about that. So I don't think this is necessarily a crisis-driven thing. If you're interested in water, and presumably you are, my guess is none of you have any trouble finding stuff to write about.
And you know, I guess I would argue that the news stories here are the integrative nature of water. And the water energy story was the first one that came out of this. You're going to see bunches more of this.
Well, climate and water.
Climate and
energy
water.
And water.
Water relation, water, energy,
water and conflict.
Nitrogen
energy
and water. Water quality. I mean, we've not much talked here about water quality, but that's an upcoming story. And the
big
nitrogen
story.
Cycle and water cycle, this whole concept of biogeochemical cycles. Water, carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, iron, all these things, a lot of these things are totally out of whack. If you look at Rockstrom's piece that was referred to here, I mean, there's some great new angles, I think, on water.
Mm-hmm.
Water and infrastructure, Valerie's comment.
Yeah.
There's a growing discussion about local municipalities and money and financing and
But you guys see all of this and you guys see the connections between water and energy and talk about all of this and we may know it, but it really hasn't sunk in with the general public, I think.
Well,
when you look at the number when you look at the number of people who still, you know, water their lawns prolifically and so on, I mean, I don't think the big picture has sunk in. Go ahead, Valerie.
I was struggling at first to understand what your question was. But then my thoughts are that actually the media has been caught in a crisis definition that has been so much around the water crisis, the pollution crisis, the drought crisis. It's about what's going on in the system, but not at all enough on what I see as the fundamental crisis in the management issue, which is a huge financial pressure on communities at the same time as EPA is ramping up its enforcement mandates, whether it's stormwater or CSOs or nutrients or just run-of-the-mill upgrades to your treatment plants. The financial crisis is way underreported. It's like an earthquake. The earth is moving now. The question is, which way is it going to go? The Republicans in the Congress would like to see, as I said, a rollback to some degree. Harvard Business School folks, they're talking about massive wave of privatization coming. These stories aren't getting reported, but those are the ones that citizens and communities are actually facing. And I also don't think that there's enough coverage of and this is, you know, in generally in the political arena, there's as much going on in water technology and innovation and what should we do as there is in the energy field. But
true.
Because climate crisis is so popular, everyone focuses on renewables and efficiency and whatever. And that story about the revolution needed in technology and economics and the way that we deal with these things is not being reported at all. So mm-hmm. I think there is a big crisis. It just isn't getting mm-hmm. reported.
Mm-hmm. Peter, your comment that per capita water use is going down was an important comment. And we as reporters, we're covering these, whether it be local government or state government or federal issues, we cover these meetings. We get press releases every year from the American Society of Civil Engineers who say we must spend $255 billion a year to fix all of our water infrastructure. We constantly hear this need. We've got to fix this. We need more supply. We need bigger. And yet you say we're using less water all the time. We see industry using less water all the time. We see ag using less water all the time. How do we as reporters cover that story in a better way so that taxpayers really know, you know, just how much of an infrastructure crisis we have and what is the smartest way to deal with it long term?
Okay. All of those things are true. Demand for water totally and per person is going down. But we also have a very serious infrastructure crisis and we need to spend more money, or money differently, one might argue. And demand for water isn't going down everywhere. It's going up in some regions still. It's going down in other regions. It's going up in some sectors. It's going down in others. I mention it for a couple of reasons. One is because it's an indication, first of all, that the old assumptions that the only thing we had to do, and this was the way we did water in the 20th century, it was supply, supply, supply. How do you find more water for your growing cities in the Southwest or growing industry or growing agriculture, wherever. You build another dam, you tap another groundwater well, you move water from the next river basin over, and if it's got to be the Mississippi and you have to take it all the way to Las Vegas, we'll do that, or Alaska and we'll bring it down to Mexico. I mean, you can imagine it, an engineer can design it. But we're running up against limits, physical limits on how much water is available and that you can use, economic limits on how much money we have and are willing to spend for certain things, environmental limits that constrain what we're allowed to do now. We didn't care about the salmon 50 years ago or the fish or the... We didn't care, or we didn't know that we ought to care, or we didn't know that we were going to be doing bad things to those things. Well, we care now. It's hard to build traditional infrastructure, water infrastructure, because we are paying attention to the environment now, so that's another factor. So what do you do? The Colorado River is a great example. The Colorado River is the biggest river in the southwestern U.S. It goes through seven states and Mexico. We have a treaty with Mexico, and water's allocated through a complex set of laws that developed over decades to all of those different parties, and Brad alluded to them. And this gets to this issue of peak water. We're using all of it. It's a renewable resource. Whatever we use this year doesn't affect how much nature's going to give us next year. There's more water coming. But there's a limit. You can't use more water in the Colorado River than is in the Colorado River. And so more supply can't be the answer anymore. So demand is beginning. We're beginning to think about demand. We're beginning to think about efficiency. We're beginning to think about how we use water. We're growing more food with less water. We're flushing our toilets with 1.6 gallon per flush toilets instead of 6 gallon per flush toilets. We're taking our showers have lower low flow shower heads, although
who has two shower heads? Who in this room has two shower heads?
Can you believe that there are two shower heads in our bathrooms?
Too low flow.
Pardon?
Too low flow.
Oh, excuse us.
But too low flow is twice the national standard for what a shower should be. All right, so have you all figured out how to turn off one of those showers?
No.
You can. You have to move the little lever. And, in fact, then the flow in the other one goes up. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Good.
The security alarm goes off.
So instead of thinking about new supply, infinitely new supply, we have to think about the way we use water. It's a new way of thinking about water. We have to think about doing the things we want to do with less water. And that's efficiency, productivity. I could go on. But that's the reason why the demand for water in the U.S. is one of the reasons, has leveled off and has started to go down. We're becoming more efficient because there is no more easy supply. I think the curve would have kept going up if the Colorado River had been twice as big. We would have used the rest of it. If there had been another big river there, if our groundwater wasn't being overpumped. I think part of the reason is that we're running up against physical and economic and environmental limits. Just say one more thing. I actually don't think we don't have enough money. I actually think we have enough money. The federal government never paid for all of our water infrastructure. Our water infrastructure is paid for mostly by our water bills, and I mean our urban infrastructure, not the subsidized agricultural stuff. It's paid for by our water bills and by the ability of our public agencies to sell municipal bonds, public bonds, at lower interest rates than private bonds. That's what drove investment in the water infrastructure in the U.S. And I think we could, I know there's money problems, and I'm not disputing that, but I actually think it's a priority decision kind of policy question, not an absolute shortage of money.
Brad, I'd like to ask you to follow up. You mentioned price and markets. And so this sort of leads from what Peter was saying. And then when you mentioned price and markets, I saw Valerie flinch. So I wanted you to go back to that and follow up on price and markets and what might be ideal. And then, Valerie, if you'd like to, you can, you know, tell us what concerns you have, if any, about markets.
So, I mean, for years, economists have talked about getting water prices right. And this is obviously a different kind of good, and one can't just let a market run amok on it. But there are clearly ways to get pricing involved in helping us decide what resources we should use to what purpose. I mean, we use markets all the time in almost every transaction we do to allocate resources. That's what they do. They do it beautifully. They take all these independent actors and come up with signals that make sense and optimally allocate resources. What you have to be concerned about is the environment going to get a decent share in a market-based system? And everyone thinks that there's a basic human right to water that either should be free, which I would disagree with, or should be at very low cost. And you need to deal with those two issues before you then let your market turn loose. The Australians now have 20 plus years of experience with markets. Maybe that's a little bit more like 15. Last year in the Murray-Darling Basin, they did $3 billion worth of market-based transactions. And according to Clinton Grafton and others at ANU in Canberra, the university there, the reductions in agricultural output during this incredible, unprecedented drought were really quite minimal, less than 10%. And there were two reasons for this. One, run-up in world ag prices and commodity prices, and two, these markets that allowed water to go from really low-value things like rice growing and cotton growing to keeping the grapes of South Australia watered, which is really important. And we can learn from these lessons. I think the markets are incredibly powerful, and we're going to have to get the price signal right in water. That's my two bits. There's no other way to solve some of these problems than to get markets to help us solve them.
Mm-hmm. So let me first say just a little bit about Australia, because I do work with a lot of folks from down there in various institutes, and they have a lot of concern, actually, that Australia is still stuck on resolving some of these issues. You mentioned desal plants. with the same old very large industrial scale and expensive and side effects, the brine, et cetera, approaches where they're still cautious about moving in the direction that there's a huge groundswell about green infrastructure in new subdivisions, not just water efficiency in the home, but reuse of rainwater, recycling of wastewater, energy recovery, a lot of other things. And so I'm not sure that Australia is that great an example. As much as there is a great dialogue down there, they're still acting out of an old approach. But, I did kind of react because I think we are at a really interesting moment of, again, it is not just in the ecosystem that the crisis is getting worse. It's in the financial world as well, and whether communities... I spend a lot of time on Cape Cod, actually, where they're talking about a nutrient issue in estuaries requiring a sewer system. This is that old technology that could be $60,000 to $80,000 a home when 60% of people there are earning under $20,000. Now, there's a huge revolt going on. I mean, the issue is that amount of money being spent at all in the right way for a host of objectives? And there is what Cynthia has called a water industrial complex of engineers and construction companies, and they move in and out of the bureaucracies, and they're buttressed by this old Clean Water Act, and they're continuing to want to stamp out these very, very expensive systems that don't deliver much at all and are not financially sustainable going forward. But the amazing thing about this moment in time is that at the very time when we are all realizing that economists should not have been running the world the way they have, that finance is not directed at the right things, that it's a highly unstable system that gives all kinds of money to a few people and impoverishes communities, that we are turned to economists to say, how can we respond to the crisis? And they're full of ideas for, in water, making markets. They're so efficient. They'll work so well. And I just am, that's why I flinch, is that there's no evidence that pricing will bring sustainable management systems. It may bring a great deal of money to eventually even private utilities that build big systems that are on some compliance with some old law, but where would they ever push for in-home or recycling or decentralized or natural systems-based approaches? So I think it's an incredibly interesting time. There are proposals for how to fix this crisis that come from economists, and they think they need to be taken with a real grain of salt. And I didn't get to the sessions, but really, in fisheries, there's been the same idea that we'll solve the fish stock problem by listening to economists. And at least in Massachusetts, that's been a devastating
solution. Can I just do one little follow-up? So one example and then a more general comment. So in Australia, one of the things that happened during the drought is that the dairy farmers who use large amounts of water to grow hay to feed their cows all of a sudden found themselves with less water, but it was incredibly valuable. And so what did they do? They went and sold that water, and they took the money from that sale and bought grain for their cows. They were quite happy to do this. The people that purchased the water that were short of water were quite happy. All of a sudden, you have an economic system that's working quite efficiently with a lot of people happier with the outcome. That's the kind of substitutions and exchanges that markets can help us with. I would, let's be careful when we talk about markets and the global financial meltdown, because there are markets and then there are markets, and they are not the same thing. I don't think anybody in this room is in favor of unfettered markets, and that's not what I'm talking about. But we utilize markets for everything we do, and to not utilize it in water to allocate resources is fundamentally dumb. We can do it.
I really want to get to the journalist questions. And I wanted to follow up on one thing. A lot of you are, I've heard a couple of people saying they're going to do anniversary. We usually don't do anniversary stories. That's like a big no-no. But when it comes to the Clean Water Act, some of us will, because it's a good, it's a very good time to assess. So it's just gives you some more sides. And I think one of the really interesting places to look at was Philadelphia and the all-green stormwater plan. So that was the story where, to halt sewage spills and comply with the Clean Water Act, they were looking at a $10 billion price tag for a massive sewage tunnel under the Delaware River. Instead, Philadelphia will spend $1.6 billion to restore streams, remake everything from parking lots to basketball courts with porous pavement, and plant miles of vegetation atop rooftops and city blocks. So that would be a really good city to look at as we write some of these stories and see how that's going. Tom, and if everyone can give your name, identify your organization, and the ground rules here for the Q&A is that I'm supposed to call on SEJ working members of the media first and then take everyone. Go ahead, Tom Henry with the Toledo Blade.
Right. I'm now on the editorial board after being an environmental writer for years and having covered this issue for a number of years. We in Toledo are on the largest collection of fresh surface water, but there's a really odd thing going on in Toledo, speaking of infrastructure. The roof of our water treatment plant is literally caving in. There, right today, if you were to go there, our editorial board toured there a week or two ago. There's a mesh screen holding up pieces of the roof that are crumbling and would be getting into the water treatment. They need a $1 million new roof. There's pipes that haven't been replaced from the 50s, crumbling infrastructure. The instrumentation looks like something out of Dr. Strangelove. We all get that politicians didn't have the guts to raise rates as they should have been, and now things are reaching a crisis stage. But as an editorial board, we looked at that and we said it doesn't do any good to keep looking back and trying to figure out which administration to blame, because we need to move forward. In an economically distressed city like Toledo, where one out of four people are living below the poverty line, how do you sell this? You know, that it's a crisis, but it's not quite a crisis yet. You just can't keep limping along with the roof caving in on your water treatment plant.
Who wants to take that one?
Well, there are some people who... Toledo's like everywhere else. I mean, yeah. We've got degraded infrastructure, you know, collapsing roads, whatever. But some people think that it's maybe a bit of an opportunity for this country. You know, China is building cities with whole new ideas. They won't build those water and sewer systems in the way that Toledo did. So why should America throw all this money at just rebuilding the way it was done when other countries are recognizing that that's not the way to do it? So maybe Toledo should think about new and better ways to get much more value for the community. Philadelphia is a perfect example of using a natural systems-based approach to deal with the stormwater that delivers huge benefits of air quality, recreation space, kids learn more. You know, green infrastructure is a great bonanza of community benefits. Another one to think about, though, that's emerging is profit centers in your wastewater, which is... We're throwing away the organic energy in the wastewater. We're throwing away the value of the nutrients. Maybe Toledo could actually start to even make some money off of the wastewater system if they thought about it in a different way.
Valerie, is there an example of that Tom could go out anywhere in the world and see that where it's working and write about it?
Yeah, I mean, this is happening so rapidly, but one of the biggest stories in the profession is that connection of water and energy. It's not just how much use there is, but the capacity of resource recovery. This is, like I mentioned, agriculture, you know, closing loops, green chemistry. In the water, wastewater field, huge potential.
But we need a place.
Changing completely the economics. And those are being installed in the United States as we speak.
I made the point in an editorial that other than public safety, there's nothing that government provides that's more important than clean water and sewage. And we were wondering, if the Obama administration wants to stimulate the economy with you know, infrastructure jobs, why aren't we putting more of the stimulus money into water and sewer infrastructure instead of roads?
In part because water and sewer infrastructure are local projects. They're not funded by the federal government. They should be funded by the users. Now, you made the comment politicians don't have the guts to raise rates, and that's completely true countrywide. But it's also true that often when they raise the rates, the water board guys get voted out. And so it's not they don't have the guts because there's a reason.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there are examples where water rates have been raised very successfully when the public is told what they're getting for their money. All of us pay less for water than we pay for internet, cell phones, landlines, cable TV, energy, separately. Not all together, but separately. Water's the cheapest of our bills. And yet, arguably, a smart politician, municipality would be able to explain, we don't want the roof falling in on our wastewater treatment plant. We don't want bad water coming out of our taps. We don't want your flushed toilet to end up in Lake Erie untreated. To make the argument that modest increases in rates so that we're actually, this gets back to Brad's point about water prices, that if we're willing to pay for the services we want, then it's easier to do those things. I do agree with Valerie. There is an opportunity. I don't want to be glib about this, but there are different ways of doing things today than the old style that are sometimes cheaper, have multiple benefits. It's hard to say abandon your old system and build this new thing when you have an immediate need. But there are some opportunities, and the innovative municipalities are looking at those.
Rob,
just do one?
Sure.
One quick lesson from Australia: independent price setter for water rates. Get it out of the political sphere. Treat it much as we do electricity and other utilities. Mm-hmm. A totally independent body. That's what they've implemented nationally as part of their water reforms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rob. Hey.
Rob Davis, reporter for Voice of San Diego. Water rates have gone up about 80%.
Whoa. They don't like those water rates going up 80%.
Water rates have gone up like 80% in San Diego since 2007. And, you know, we can all, I think, agree that using less water is good. And I'm just curious how you create that incentive for water utilities. In San Diego, as water rates have gone up, they've had to lay people off. They've had to postpone capital purchases. I mean, for those water utilities, it's in their best interest to sell as much water as they can, and there's not a lot of talk about resolving that issue. I'm curious what the answer is.
I'll quickly say, Rob, I think it's a myth that water utilities can't be financially healthy unless they sell us more water. That is the conventional wisdom of a water utility, but water utilities all over our country and Australia, Perth is a very good example, San Antonio is a great example. You could look at some of these places where water utilities have proven that they can make more revenue and sell less water. And one way they've done that is to buy conserved water from some of the largest water users in the community. But I'll let the panelists jump in. Brad, do you have?
Well, I guess the only thing I would say is that for years we fooled our customers, our water customers, into thinking they're buying widgets at a per unit price on widgets. And that's obviously not the case with water utilities. The cost of these utilities, this is a business model no one would ever get into unless you had monopoly pricing power, and then you'd go crazy with it because you'd love it. Unfortunately, we don't let utilities act like monopolies, and we constrain their pricing. And so they present us this bill that looks like we're buying it on the costs that they face are on a per unit basis, and nothing could be further than the truth, right? The marginal cost of an additional gallon of water is the price of chemicals and energy in it, which is minuscule relative to the infrastructure cost. And again, this is a public educational issue, I think, to get away from this notion of how these costs are presented to people. I don't think it's helpful.
Who else has a question? Yes.
You had asked, I'm Dan Sullivan of BioCycle Magazine.
Yes.
We actually covered the Philadelphia story.
Yes.
Water. If anybody's interested, it's in our March issue, it's www.biocycle.net.
Great.
But two examples of utilities capturing your organics that you asked for.
Yes, that's what we need as journalists. We like to be able to go to a place and say, here's how this is working. That would be, yeah.
I would say Marin County, and they're also, instead of flaring their gas, they're capturing it and using it to run their facility.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also taking in food waste, which adds to the methane production, and also East Bay Municipal Utility District.
Where's East Bay?
That's my yeah. utility.
Oh, district. That's you.
It's Oakland, Berkeley,
and how
East
is
Bay.
That? How is that
yeah.
going?
No, they've been very good on conservation and efficiency. They're good on capturing methane from their waste treatment plant, and it reduces their energy costs.
Mm-hmm.
It's
They
spent. Okay, so that's actually an interesting example. EBMUD, East Bay Municipal Utility District. They spent $250 million in the last 5 or 8 years. Building earthquake-resistant infrastructure for their water system. Huge capital expense with ratepayer money, my money, because we live in an earthquake zone. They had to build, strengthen reservoirs. They had to strengthen pipelines. They had to put in place emergency equipment. Before they started the project, there was a big public community discussion. They said, look, we want to raise your rates, and here's what we want to do with the money. And the community said, okay, I like your plan. I like the idea that, in fact, after an earthquake, I'm still going to be able to get water within 3 days, maybe, as opposed to 2 weeks. And anyway, we paid for that. We were willing to pay for that infrastructure investment because we thought we knew what we were getting.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard anyone on the panel mentioned groundwater, and I was a little bit surprised that I never heard the word, because groundwater is a huge issue for us in Florida. Floridians rely on groundwater. About 90% of us rely on it. When it gets overpumped, we have enormous sinkholes open under highways, homes, and even an elementary school. And
I used the word aquifer once.
And yeah, here in Miami, we're drinking the Biscayne aquifer water. But I wondered if maybe Peter could talk a little bit about groundwater. I actually got a press release earlier, was it last week, from the Cadiz Aquifer Project in California. That said, their national panel had come out with its study that showed it will do no harm to the groundwater being pumped. Is it from the Mojave Desert? Maybe you could talk a little bit about groundwater.
Well, groundwater is without a doubt sort of the most neglected component of the hydrologic cycle. We don't think about it much. People in general don't know where their water comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, ask somebody where it comes from, and don't let them say the tap,
and you get
sort of stunned silence. But a lot of our water nationwide comes from groundwater. Rechargeable, nature recharges groundwater normally over time, and it's just another source of water. But it's out of sight and it's out of mind, and it's typically not managed very well. In the western United States, there are all sorts of weird laws or no laws governing groundwater withdrawals and use, and it leads to problems.
So is there no groundwater regulation in California?
It depends on where you are.
Mm-hmm. So it's local regulation then?
There's very little. Sometimes if you have land and you drill a well, you can pump as much groundwater as you want. In Texas, it's called the right of capture, and it leads to problems. It leads to problems in two ways. When your use of water is faster than nature recharges it, it's not sustainable. And then, instead of a renewable water resource like the Colorado River, you get a non-renewable resource like oil, hence peak oil. And when you use it, the groundwater levels drop and it gets more expensive to pump. And then farmers go out of production. And we've seen this in the Ogallala Aquifer in the Great Plains of the U.S. and in Central California and the Central Valley of California and Northern China and in India. We're consuming it in a non-renewable way. So that's one problem. The other problem is contamination. When you contaminate groundwater, and this is one of the concerns with fracking, natural gas fracking, if you contaminate groundwater, it's hard to uncontaminate. It's easy to screw it up, and it's really hard to unscrew it up. A lot of the big Superfund issues, the toxic waste issues, are groundwater contamination. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and because we don't monitor, because we don't regulate, that's a serious challenge.
Brad, in your solutions-oriented work, do you propose solutions to the groundwater issues we're talking about? Is that...
You know, and it's funny, in the Colorado River Basin, Arizona is highly dependent upon aquifers, but they've tried to get off of those.
Right.
And they actually have a fairly forward-looking law that was passed in 1980, actually, in response to the development of the Central Arizona Project. Bruce Babbitt and the state endured this interesting little dance to get that law passed.
Yeah, California, we wish we had a law like that.
Yeah.
And Arizona's way ahead of us.
You know, I think groundwater actually has an interesting potential role here. Arizona's doing lots of groundwater recharge right now out of the Colorado River, and I think you're going to find aquifer storage and recharge, a concept that's been around for years, and you're going to see a lot more of it, I think, in the future as we need to store water some places where we haven't previously stored it. Surface storage probably didn't happen in this century, but groundwater, aquifer storage and recharge, there's a lot of opportunities there.
Yes, Anne, do you have... sorry, Heather. Anne... Yeah.
I have a question for Valerie. I live in Massachusetts. We're at Quabbin Reservoir, right in the western part of the state. And most of us in the eastern part of the state are drinking that water. Now, how would you, in this day and age, how would you revise that system? Or would you leave that in place?
Great question. Because it is there, and there's kind of ample rainfall and water distribution in eastern Massachusetts. But you've probably noticed that, there, like with Charles River Watershed Association, there is a lot of questioning about communities that are not linked in and also just dealing with demands of the future. And a lot of what they're coming up with is a more complex understanding of, not. And this is a perfect example, instead of just a big reservoir and pipe it in through huge pipes, which, by the way, there were boil water orders last year because one of the pipes broke. These are not particularly resilient systems when catastrophes strike. So the ideas that Charles River Watershed Association are coming up with are a number of those that I have, you would attach into a more complex natural systems-based approach. They believe in a lot of recycling and reuse. Littleton is trying to look at, actually, can you manage water locally with a lot more reuse of gray water and black water, and also on the side, energy recovery? Can you capture rainwater locally? And shouldn't you actually be infiltrating locally? I mean, there, several of the questions come up of, well, how do we price a water rate, or can we use an aquifer for storage capacity? There's still so much in what I would call the industrial big pipe, single-purpose, siloed service bill, you know. And a lot of thinking is that water needs to be looked at in its complex system and referencing how nature manages water. And nature is going to localize and reuse, and it's going to be part of a natural system that generates huge amounts of value, like, you know, the wastewater recovery that was mentioned over here. And so in eastern Massachusetts, I'm not sure they're going to stop that MWRA, but the new systems have that quality of complexity and natural systems based. And that doesn't, it's a totally different mindset. And part of the problem is that professionals have been so defining management, and then they talk to the public through water rates, when actually communities very much need, as Cynthia said, to look at water in a very new and much more holistic way, understand what water used to do and is doing in their community, and attempt to mimic and use natural systems and high-tech science as well to replicate again a very abundant, clean, natural systems base. There's far more value when you start using water in that way. And instead of a net drain to build these big concrete systems that break down, you're actually getting cooling results, you're getting cleansing results, you're getting nutrient recovery, you're getting energy recovery. And water can generate huge benefits to gray cities that are all concrete. I mean, we covered every river. We cut down every tree. These are parts of the water system that we need to restore much more of how water would operate in the cities, and in the process generate huge benefits that are not just a gallon of water, mm-hmm. but, as I said, recreation space, cooling space, you know, cooling okay. benefits, et cetera.
I need to, I want Heather to ask her question, but I'll say quickly to follow up on that. Here in Miami, the Miami River used to actually have rapids on it. Now children can't even see it because it's just, you know, so much concrete that the Dade County Public Schools actually have to take inner city kids on field trips to the Miami River because otherwise they would have never seen the river that runs through their home. And so we've all heard from the Cousteaus a lot over the last couple of days. You guys weren't here last night, but the whole family has been here talking to us about the same theme, and they keep quoting Jacques Cousteau, who said, people protect what they love and they can't protect what they can't understand. And so that goes back to what we've been saying about people don't know where their water comes from, how it comes out of the tap like magic, where it goes after they flush the toilet. And so that's all part of our job. You know, we're part of those new players that you're talking about. Journalists are all part of that. Heather, what's your question? Sorry for making you wait.
No problem. Heather Dewar, a freelance environment reporter in Baltimore, where many of these problems are magnified. And I share your enthusiasm, and so does Baltimore City, for alternative methods, especially for stormwater filtration and the urban greening that results from that. However, I wonder whether or not you all know of places where the scientific data shows that it really is possible to achieve the kind of clean water results that we have to have in places where the infrastructure is so degraded that we have sewage seeping into groundwater.
Well, isn't Philadelphia our big experiment, right? That's what EPA is. They're letting Philadelphia do this on the large scale. And
are there results yet?
No, I don't think so. Go ahead,
well,
Peter.
This is a really, really important thing about the Clean Water Act, which more and more people are realizing is from the early 70s is not serving us well at this point, is that, and actually out your way, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Kansas City, and now New York, EPA is agreeing to consent decrees that are diverging quite a bit from past practice in the following way. They're allowing these communities to install green infrastructure with promises to monitor. And if it works out okay, then even do the whole city that way. And the problem with the Clean Water Act is that over and over and over and over, because it is so siloed and old in its technology, it's forcing communities to do this very expensive traditional infrastructure. So the revolution that out your way, and Baltimore would discover this as well, is that EPA is now opening to the regulatory framework. They're pushing. How much under the Clean Water Act can we let America innovate? I mean, it's the most retarding innovation and change in this country that you can imagine.
I want to make sure we get to Susan's question, but Peter, yes, please, go ahead.
I normally find myself arguing innovation, what I call the soft path, non-traditional technology, and so on. I think that's really important, and I really agree with Valerie. But today, I just want to make the point that we're not talking about getting rid of the existing infrastructure. We've built a system with really big centralized cities with massive generation of concentrations of human and industrial waste. Natural systems offer enormous benefits. Opening up rivers that have been paved over offer cultural and social benefits. But smart technology, centralized wastewater collection and treatment, is much more sophisticated today than it was 100 years ago. And we need to replace the old centralized plants, not with entirely decentralized systems, but sometimes with new centralized plants that are smaller, more energy efficient, remove the pharmaceuticals that we now find in our water systems that we didn't know were there before or weren't there before. So what I'm arguing for is a mix of that handles the systems we already have, that build on the systems we already have, but that take advantage of the new, broader thinking that's out there.
Susan, you had your hand up for a while. What's your question?
Yeah, if I can articulate it well, and this is partly reflecting my ideological ignorance, but so I read your report, the Pacific Institute's report on Tulare County and Central Valley, and largely the nitrate pollution.
Yeah.
So some of that is surface water, a lot of that is groundwater. I'm wondering, well, first of all, for those everywhere, if you were to do reports like that elsewhere, what would be the hotspots? And then, I guess, more specifically, to what degree is it a groundwater problem that actually can be solved? I mean, I know it points to the Blue Baby Syndrome and stuff, but I've heard a lot of the farmers in the area saying, you can't say it's all our problem because it's a legacy. You know, hydrologically, these nitrates were very farmed decades ago, have taken decades to get to the water system, so how can we, I guess the question is, not just pointing fingers, but if you were in a regulatory seat, what would you do?
Okay, so for those of you not familiar with what we're talking about, the Institute did a report a little while ago looking at the populations in the Central Valley of California who are drinking unsafe water, nitrate-contaminated water, because they don't have access to safe drinking water here in the United States. They're in small rural communities. They're typically low-income communities. They're typically minority communities. The nitrates come from agricultural wastewater, runoff, nutrient-rich surface runoff that goes into the groundwater, or combined feeding operations for big animals, or septic tanks. There are a bunch of sources. It makes my point. Once the groundwater is contaminated, it's really hard to uncontaminate. Mm-hmm. So some of these communities could, if the money were available, and it's not at the moment, treat their groundwater to acceptable standards or link to other local water systems that are not contaminated, or there are alternatives for them, but we haven't provided them. In the long run, the first thing you have to do is stop the contamination. You have to prevent it. Prevention, you know, we learned this with Lake Erie in the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act 40 years ago, is the first thing you want to do, because treatment is so much more expensive later on. We have technology to solve these water problems, but we don't do it because we don't have the money, or we don't care about low-income communities, or there's a whole separate discussion going on about environmental equity issues. But it's a long conversation.
And you guys have three fabulous sources here for these stories. Go ahead. I'm going to take one more question. I'm sorry. Jay has admonished me to stop this at 12 o'clock so we can all go to flood, sweat, and fears, climate change, and extremes. But please ask one more question, and then we'll wrap up. And everyone, feel free. These are three wonderful sources for us to be able to use on Clean Water Act stories and all our many other stories over the year to come. Go ahead.
Sammy Freelance, radio reporter from California. This question, I guess, would be Peter, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. First, as we growing population and the implications of food production, how we can feed this many people. How does the water story tie into that? I'm curious about kind of international.
Okay, so I said at the beginning water is connected to everything. One of those things critically is food production. 80% of the world's water that's used by humans on average, 70-80%, goes to grow food, to agriculture. Only a small fraction goes to industry and commercial and industrial and residential uses. We're running up against limits in a lot of places in the ability to expand irrigated agriculture land and the water to provide it. Water is critically important, so we have to get more efficient. We have to figure out how to grow more food with the same amount of water or less water. The good news is we're doing that. We've been doing that for a long time. In California, we grow a lot more food now than we used to with the same amount or less water, with efficient irrigation technology, with changing crop types, with soil moisture monitoring. There's innovative technologies that let farmers do more. A lot of the world's food production comes from unsustainable groundwater overpumping. And I'm not sure what we're going to do about that. Somebody's estimated that as much as 30 to 40% of the world's food production comes from unsustainable groundwater. Groundwater levels that are dropping, getting gets more expensive. You have to find other sources or you raise prices and you raise rates.
Including in our own high plains, right?
In the high plains, mm-hmm. in California and China and India, the places, mm-hmm. some of the places
mm-hmm.
I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So is that sort of a quick...
Yeah.
It's a serious problem.
And please, everyone, please follow up with these three. They're wonderful sources, and we all appreciate so much that you've come all the way to the tip of the continent to be with us. Thank you. It was great to hear from all of you.